get by. It resides between my eyes. Walked through the fire, came out better on the other side. See, life's like a beach if you find the sand. And right now, I'm feeling like $100,000. Dr. Jeremy Weiss here. I'm founder of InspiredInsider.com, where I talk with inspirational entrepreneurs and leaders like founders of P90X, Baby Einstein, Atari, many more, and how they overcome big challenges in life and business. Today, I have David Kekich. Now, what would you do with an extra 20 or 30 youthful energetic years? Does the thought of never dying from old age or even limitless youth sound like a fantasy? Now, imagine being smart, strong, and sexy at age 100. Today we have David Kekich, who is a recognized authority on longevity science. He founded the Maximum Life Foundation in 1999 and is dedicated to curing aging-related diseases. You can find it at maxlife.org. He's also the CEO of Age Reversal Inc. and PsyCog. Now, they have a team of world-renowned scientists and researchers working on cutting-edge health innovations. He's been featured in several prominent life extension documentaries, TV, radio, and as I mentioned, he's the author of Smart, Strong, and Sexy at 100, New Skin, New Hair, New You, 7 Simple Steps to Thrive at 100 and Beyond. I highly recommend it. Dave, thanks for being with me.
Well, thank you, Jeremy. Thanks for having me. And I guess you covered everything, so
we can end right now.
There's nothing left.
You know, I always like to ask people, Inspired Insider, what's been a low point? What's been a low moment, and how you push through it?
Oh, gee, when I got hurt, I had a spinal cord injury.
Yeah,
and that was the lowest point in my life until my mother died. But that was definitely the low point. I mean, it took me a long time to get out of that.
Yeah,
mentally, it took me a long time to get out of it.
I mean, I was shocked when I listened to your book and you said that, because it's almost, you know, said in a normal tone, that kind of not nonchalant, but just said kind of a matter of fact what happened. And I had to kind of go back and listen to it again to make sure I heard it correctly, because it just sounded just like a freak thing.
Oh, it was weird. Yeah, I was lifting and in the gym, and I'd been doing that for years and years and years before that. And I just had a sharp pain at the base of my neck. And I had to stop lifting, and I went in and played some ping pong and came back. I just thought I pulled something. And one thing led to another. I worked out for a while, and then pain came back. It's crazy. I went over, and the only position I can get in that would relieve the pain would be a fetal position. So I laid down on this padded table that people would do exercises on. And I started doing crunches because I could do those. And I never dreamed that something was going wrong, but I had a hematoma, a slow bleed. Something popped. And it was just a weakness or something, some weird, crazy, freak accident.
Yeah.
And it was a slow bleed, and there was pressure building up on my spinal. It was inside my spinal canal.
Right.
So the blood was slowly pushing on my spinal cord. And I went to the hospital. And they admitted me, of course. I was screaming like an animal, and they couldn't diagnose it.
Wow.
So the diagnosis finally was paralysis about a day later.
Jeez.
And they rushed me in and did a what they call a laminectomy. They opened me up, removed a few of the spinuses, and drained it.
Relieve the pressure.
Yeah, it was too late.
I mean, what testing did they have in those days? Did they have...
You know, CAT scans were rare. They didn't have one there. They didn't have MRIs. They did a, what do they call it? They injected some dye when I finally went paralyzed. They injected dye into my cerebral spinal fluid, and they were looking at it on a screen, or actually on like an X-ray, and you could see the white dye going up to the point of injury, and then it wouldn't go any further. Cool. So it was being blocked. So they knew there was a blockage there, and that's when they went in.
Wow, that is
a little bit too little, a little too late.
I can't even believe that when I heard it. Yep. Was this like a slow process that it happened, or was it almost like
except for the pain, I could move around freely and felt, you know, I had feeling everything. I do it now in my arms, but I had feeling in my chest and my legs and everything. But then all of a sudden I started getting this tingling feeling, And then I couldn't move. Couldn't move my legs or anything. So
wow.
My hands either. My hands were, it was a high injury, but the swelling kept my hands from functioning very well. But they told me that I'd get my hand function back. I have, I don't know, I have 80% of it probably. So, I mean, yeah. It feels normal to me. It doesn't
yeah. Yeah. My wife, they won't allow her to have an epidural for the pregnancy because she's got like a blood clotting disorder, and they were worried if they did the epidural that would happen. Actually, it wouldn't clot and it would yeah. rush in, and so they wouldn't give her the epidural because of that.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, how do you get through something like that? I mean, that's got to be one of the toughest things.
Oh, you suffer. I mean, at first I couldn't believe it, and I just didn't think. I just thought it was temporary. I just didn't know anything about spinal cord injuries. And, you know, you see all the people on television, movies, going through these parallel bars, and they're walking, and they're recovering from a war wound or something. And
right.
That's what I envisioned. I said, oh, geez, I'm going to have to go through all this rehab and gradually get back again. It's going to take a lot of work, but I was ready for that. But then when they finally told me, it didn't tell me right away. They finally told me that was it. It was permanent.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was, you know, obviously, I mean, I was a runner, a distance runner, and I lifted all the time, and was a very physical guy, and it all ended. So when that ended, I thought my life ended. I really did. And you know, looking back, I mean, that part of it ended, but other parts grew. So,
yeah.
And this too shall pass.
Yeah. Cause I'm not doing this to depress you, but I'm just thinking, you know, someone who's listening to this who may be going through something like that, or a family yeah. member going through something like that, something in your mindset that allowed you to get to a better place, I guess.
I'm here. If anybody wants to talk to me, I'd be happy to. If anybody has that issue, just email Jeremy and have him, you know, put me in touch with him. And I've done that over the years, talked to a lot of people.
Yeah.
It's tough to get through. I mean, no matter what you say, you can help, but I mean, people have to get through it. I had to get through it. I kind of shut myself off and just worked it out on my own.
Yeah. Yeah.
Again, I was a little stubborn. I wouldn't listen. But
that helps, probably. That stubbornness helps in some
way. Well, they kicked me out of rehab. I might be the only person they ever kicked out of rehab.
Why'd they kick you out?
I was recalcitrant, I guess. I just kept insisting that there would be a cure someday.
Yeah.
And because they kept telling me, well, first of all, they took all my hope away, which I never forgave them for. And I don't forgive the medical community for that. I hope they're doing better now. But I was, they kept telling me there's no way I'll ever have any functional use of my legs. I said, okay, I hear you. I said, but let's say in the future.
Right.
Let's say with all, you know, research and break. No, never. As long as you live, you'll never have it. Oh. I said, well, wait a minute. I said, how about if they do this, this, and this, you know, generally, because I didn't know anything about physiology at that time. But how about as we learn more and, you know, whatever, I'm just going on and on.
Yeah.
No. And they would strip all my, and I never forgave them for that because it really put me in a state of depression. And I wasn't very cooperative with them. What they were trying to do was just to get me focused on being able to take care of myself, on being as independent as I could be,
right.
And being able to function. But the way they did it, they really stripped me of all hope. And without hope, I mean, there's nothing. I don't care. If whatever you are, if you're any human at all and you have no hope, you might as well forget it. I mean, life, even if you struggle through it, even if you live through it, you're just existing.
Yeah.
There's nothing to look forward to. So I just wasn't very cooperative. And they, after I got out, I had a serious blood disease, or not a disease, a blood infection. And I was in another hospital in UCLA, and it was UCLA is a teaching hospital. So I was lying in this bed, and I had a private room in a rehab center, but a rehab hospital. But I was in a room with a couple of other guys or a couple of other patients, a few other ones. And then in teaching hospitals, they bring the resident, they bring the interns in, and they are in the residence, it's an extension of their training after they get their degree, and they have, you know, here comes this woman, doctor, and she would bring her students behind her, and she would was walking up to each bed, and then she'd look at the chart, and she'd read it to them, and then this and that. So she comes up to me, this is a, you know, whatever, 35-year-old, whatever, paraplegic, injury from spinal cord injury. Right now he's got this and this and this. I mean, not even looking at me. Hmm. And I'm going, I said, wait a minute. And I wouldn't call her doctor. I should have, whatever her first name was, you know, Sarah or something. I said, Sarah, wait a minute. And I said, and I didn't feel like I was stepping out of bounds at all. You know, I said, you know, I don't think I'm any different than most people in here, but probably a different than a lot of them in the respect that what I have, they tell me it's permanent. And just, I said, you're looking at me like a lab experiment.
Right.
And just a short time ago, I was running and I was on the beach and I was swimming and body surfing and doing all these cool things. And in one day, almost in a blink of an eye, this is what you see.
Right.
And I said, I have emotions. I'm depressed. I think my life came to an end. Yeah. And you come in here, don't say hello. You don't treat me like a human being.
Yeah.
And, you know, I said, if you would just teach your students one thing, have some compassion. Treat people like a human, not like a lab rat. And maybe just go up and say, hi, I'm so-and-so. How are you doing? Right. When I talk to my student, you know, but she was teaching these people to be crass and to be just totally, you know, cold and objective. And you're dealing with human emotions in hospitals.
Yeah.
Everywhere you go, you're dealing with human emotions. But in hospitals, they're typically, you know, about as low as they can go. So that was the kind of attitude that I saw in hospitals.
Good for you, though.
Yeah. Thanks.
I thought you were going to say then she broke down and cried and said, you're right, or something.
No. I was hoping. I only cried once.
Not you, her. I'm saying she should have.
Oh, she should have. No.
Yeah.
No, she just looked at me. Nothing. No, she didn't show any remorse.
Wow.
Nothing.
Wow.
And I was just hoping that I reached at least one of
those. That's what I thought you were going to say. Like, it changed. Wow.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
I know.
So, on the flip side, Dave, thank you for sharing that.
You're welcome.
Tough stuff. And
thought about that in a long time, but
yeah,
it's just the attitude. I think when people have medical training, they should probably screen them before they screen them for aptitude, and they screen them for all this and all that. But I think they should screen them for EQ,
bedside manner. Yeah,
EQ. If they don't have a high EQ, go into something else. Be a researcher or something. Go work at a bench with a microscope.
Yeah. What's been one of the proudest moments?
You know, when I started getting out of this depression I was in, and the proudest moment, the proudest moment wasn't getting out of depression. The proudest moment was accomplishing what I did to get out of the depression, which resulted in getting me back in the game of life. And that was
literally literally life. Yeah,
literally life. And I was living back in Pennsylvania again. I actually went around the world. I spent 15 I didn't believe these people here, so I spent 15 months around the world, mostly in Asia, trying to find a cure, because somebody told me about this person, that person, so I ended up just following these, you know, these grasping for straws. But
yeah,
after my business was gone, everything was gone, my property was gone. So I went back to Pennsylvania for a short period of time, I thought, but I ended up being back there a long time. But I was vegetating, and I didn't want to go back there. I just thought I'd drop, because I left from California, landed in New York. So I went to stay with a friend in Philadelphia for a while, and then went back to in Western PA, and was there for, you know, I was thinking a short time until I regrouped, but I ended up being back there a long time. And so I started a chapter, a local chapter for the Spinal Cord Society, and I was fundraising for research. And I put on a drug-free powerlifting event. It was called American Drug-Free Powerlifting Association. Yeah. And I got the field house at a local call. It was actually University. It was a University of Pittsburgh at Johnstown, and I got their field house and started advertising. And I brought call it the Eastern U.S. Drug Free Powerlifting Championships, and we got people from, I don't know, maybe seven states.
Wow!
And all these different weight classes and whatever. We had a polygraph guy there testing them for, you know, do you really take drugs or not? And I got tons of media exposure and newspapers, television, radio, everything was going out, not just locally, but regionally. And then we were mailing these people in the newsletter and got a huge turnout. And, I made a little money. I mean, I was excited. But what that taught me was that my mind, my brain still works.
Yeah.
And it gave me a whole new perspective. And that led to some really interesting things, which ultimately led me to where I am now.
Yeah.
With a life extension, everything at all. It's funny, from that one seed, it went to another fundraiser, then some oldies dances, and then I decided to have kind of an extravaganza oldies dance, and I rented the local hometown arena.
Really?
And I had all these oldies bands, and I had a bunch of bands and from all around the area. I brought people out of retirement. It was kind of a big reunion for all the whole community, the surrounding areas, and they came to see their old bands that they used to follow around, and I had a couple thousand people. We only
Great
100 and ended up selling like 2,000 tickets. And I mean, the arena held more, but for the dance floor and everything, we wanted to hold it to 1,800.
Right.
And actually made enough money. That was shortly before I left town for California again. And I made enough money to fund our first scientific conference, where our first Manhattan Beach, that's where the Manhattan Beach Project got its name. It was in Manhattan Beach, California, Marriott Hotel, and I searched around and found about 12 people around the country, one from UK, one from Israel, one might have been from Canada, but I'm not sure, but the rest of them were US, all different disciplines, brought them together, and we had a two-day brainstorm session, and we were brainstorming on how to reverse aging.
Yeah.
So it was funny. These guys were, and gals, there was one woman there, were pretty much leaders in their field, in their area.
Yeah.
But only in their little niche, in their domain, they didn't know the other people doing these other things.
Very specific research they're doing.
Yeah. And when they met each other and they started talking, magical things happened.
Hmm.
There was so much synergy. They were exchanging ideas. They were building on their ideas. You know who Aubrey de Grey is?
Sure. I've watched his TED Talk, yeah.
Okay. Well, Aubrey is quite famous now. Actually, I was spoke with him, and we're on the stage together in Palm Springs this weekend.
For some reason, on your Wikipedia page, his picture...
Somebody
is
told me
the
that.
Picture.
I went there.
That's not Dave. That's Aubrey de Grey.
I thought that was taken down. That's funny.
But yeah, anyways. Yeah.
Yeah. We look a little different, Aubrey.
Yeah, a little bit. Just a little bit.
Down at his waist. it's just funny. He's a great guy and one of the most brilliant people I ever met in my life. But Aubrey was not known at that time. Now he's, almost for sure, the most famous gerontologist in the world. He's out of Cambridge, UK. And he's living in up in the Mountain View, California now, most of the time. But Aubrey came up with his whole concept there.
Really?
That's where you got to start. Yeah.
Wow.
And we had Michael Rose was there. He met a guy from Affymetrics, the gene chip people, and he never heard of gene chips before. And that, he said, that shaved, I think he said 3 years or so off his research.
Wow.
And it shaved about 40% off the cost.
That's
and
amazing.
Other stories like that. So
yeah,
we ended up coming up with a scientific roadmap to reversing aging. Okay, that led into, we call it the Manhattan Beach Project. I got up, I said, look, we need
sounds official. Sounds good.
Yeah. I said, well, we need a Manhattan Project for aging. And we were in Manhattan Beach. And a guy named George Roth, he was an NIH researcher working on caloric restriction mimetics. They looked trying to build a supplement that would do the same thing.
There's some good research in your book, by the way, that people have to look at. In the rats, but yeah.
So he put his hand up. He said, let's call it the Manhattan Beach Project. And so that name stuck, and it was a pretty cool name. So from that, then Aubrey ended up having tremendous influences on people, and other people did too. Ray Kurzweil came I don't think he ever came to one of those conferences, but he joined the advisory board, a huge influence on my life.
Yeah.
Major guy. got me into the right direction as to got me into artificial intelligence, deciding that was the way to go. The exponential rate of growth kind of solidified my ideas and my projections as to when we're going to cure aging, and had a huge impact on my life, and he's a good guy too, on top of all that. So all these things, maybe not Ray, but all these things came out of this first conference. We had three since. And Calico, Google's company now to reverse aging, was influenced partially by some of these people, and Aubrey met with them. And all this stuff, and is eventually going to speed up the aging thing, all this stuff, if you go back and you trace back to where this oldies, little oldies dance.
I can't believe that.
I know, yeah. And it just changed my attitude totally. My attitude was changed from the powerlifting event.
Yeah.
And then I got more aggressive. I got more involved in doing fundraisers. And it was a total turnaround, transformation in attitude. And it just one little change in attitude for one little guy in one little town who had one little event that kind of blossomed into this amazing result.
That is amazing.
And there are other stories like that. I mean, almost everything, I think that if you find anything that was ever done in a major way, I think if you traced it back, you would find that there was a very humble beginning, a spark that set everything off.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one example as to why big things can grow out of, you know, small efforts.
Mm-hmm.
As long as you're persistent, as long as you have a plan, if you follow your passion, just stick with it. Mm-hmm. with it. Make it. If something goes wrong, you analyze it. You know, sit back and look at it, and take another approach, and you just keep hammering at it, and just persistence will pay off if it's something you really enjoy doing.
Dave, you obviously have a talent for bringing people together. I mean, what did you envision that first conference was going to be? I mean, you went from oldies to getting some of the most prominent. I mean, at the time, too, probably some of these people aren't that well known. So
how
do you even find them? And then what did you envision for the...
Well, a couple of them were well known within the small circle of anti-aging or life extension research.
Yeah.
But so I just went down. You know, the internet was there, and it wasn't nearly as sophisticated now as it is now. It didn't have as much information. But you know, I had a guy working for me. We found the people out there. He actually dug most of them up. He was a biology major. He had a master's in biology, very sharp young guy.
Yeah.
And so I just started calling them and emailing them and writing to them. And
What did you tell them? I mean, what did you envision for this?
I told them exactly what we want to do. We want to do a brainstorm session on how to reverse aging.
Really?
And we want to take we want to bring people in from all areas of aging research and just go in and just brainstorm and see what we come up with. And not one person turned us down.
What made you decide to settle on the aging? Because I would think from what the background is, let's work on spinal cord injuries. You know, and you focused in on aging at that point.
I first focused on spinal cord injuries and was raising money for that. But I determined that there are a relative handful of spinal cord injured patients. And I also determined that once we found a cure, I was going to be older. I wouldn't have much longer to live, if according to the actuaries. And a lot of the research overlaps, stem cell research, for example.
Yeah.
And I thought that I just figured that, you know, it couldn't be much more complicated. It is more complicated to solve aging, but it didn't seem much more complicated. And there were a lot of parallels.
Yeah.
But aging affects everybody.
Sure.
I mean, every adult anyway. I mean, until from the time you mature, it's all downhill from there biologically.
Yeah.
So I thought instead of 250,000 people in America anyway, more around the world, we had more like
everybody.
Yeah, we had 200 million.
Right.
Yeah. So, including me.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was my focus. But also watching my parents age and my aunts and uncles. I mean, it got to be very, it was very awful to live through and to witness.
Yeah.
And to be helpless, not be able to do anything about it.
Yeah. And so that was the early stage. seed of kind of what the Maximum Life Foundation is now. What have been some of the milestones of the Maximum Life Foundation?
Well, the big milestone was the scientific roadmap.
Mm-hmm.
Another milestone was raising enough money to launch Age Reversal Inc. And that came out of our last conference in 2009. You saw that, the Manhattan Beach Project.
Yeah.
On the online, manhattanbeachproject.com. Those things are all still valid, even though it's several years old. All the videos are up there with presentations.
Yeah.
Those basic technologies are all the same, right? All the same ones, except we didn't cover gene therapy, but we did cover genome engineering. And so we've just sophisticated, or the researchers have, they've advanced pretty far in what they're doing and have gone way beyond where we were then. Rapid, last couple of years have been incredible. We've seen a rapid increase in that. So it just feels good to have a part in that, to have it extended to Psychog Systems,
yeah,
BioViva Sciences, and in turning it into some reality now, human trials, things like that.
Yeah.
It's just the progress. It's just the journey.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Dave, you say kind of in passing, you know, we raise money, and that's a huge thing. And you were 11 years in private equity.
Well, it wasn't that long.
It wasn't. Okay.
Yeah, it was, and it was, yeah, it was, I was actually in the venture capital business from the standpoint that I was doing very small deals and finding small investors for small deals. It was funny, the way I did it was, I was actually public shells for a while, and I was either advertising those or I was advertising for money. I would run an ad in the Wall Street Journal and the U.S. Investors Business Daily and Rob Report and things like that. I would run ads, little classified ads, sometimes small space ads, but very small direct marketing. And I would say things like venture capital wanted, and then I'd do some copy. And then I'd have another one, venture capital available. and I would have people looking for money, and then I would screen the deals.
Wow.
And then I'd find the deals that made sense. And it was a learning curve for me, too, because I was a rookie at this and made mistakes. And some people lost money. And I hate to say it, but they lost money because of my bad judgment. But then other people made a lot of money because of my good luck, you know, luck of the draw. But I learned quite a bit from it. But, yeah, it was kind of cool. It very low overhead. People would call on both ends, and I just basically get in the middle. And
that's amazing. Yeah. So you were just having people from both ends come and,
yeah,
and you were,
yeah,
connecting them.
Yeah, working out of my bedroom.
So what did you learn? What's a big lesson you learned from those days when you were, because you probably put that into practice with Maximum Life Foundation?
Well, gosh, you know, I never really thought about lessons except for some of the things I learned from Galumbos and from Wallace Ward,
mm-hmm,
Dr. Ward. The I guess the biggest lessons were just what I said, persistence,
yeah,
but passion. I mean, you know, what I suggest anybody do, if they, unless they're doing something now that they've already committed their life to, if you want to be a success, just shut everything out, go away, go sit in the woods or someplace, or sit someplace where you can have some solitude, and just think. Think about what you want. You know, what do you want in life? What do I want in life? Where do I want to be in 5 years, in 10 years, in 50 years? What excites me the most? What would I do if I had all the money I needed? What would I do just because I enjoy it so much?
Yeah.
Figure that out. Figure out really what, if that takes an hour, if it takes a day or a week, or if it takes whatever, 2 weeks. But figure it out before you do anything else. Because if you start down the wrong path, you're never going to be fulfilled, and you're never going to reach your destiny. So figure out what you're good at, where your talents are, and just do a lot of self-analysis. Talk to your friends. Talk to your business associates. Ask them what they see in you, what they think you're good at. Because I think you'll get some very different answers as to what you think you're good at or what you think where your, mm-hmm, strengths are. And then start planning. Get out a pen or pencil and just write in longhand. You start writing a plan, and then go back and cross things out and add things. And then after it's all done, make your plan. It can be bullet points. And then the most important part after all that is you want to, you know, take that first step. you want to pull the trigger. Yeah. And just pull the trigger, take that first step, follow it by the second step, and just never stop. Because if you're doing something and you're progressing toward a goal that you really, really want, if you have a burning desire for it, you'll build enough momentum. Inertia will get you there. I mean, it's not that you don't have to keep reminding yourself. It's not that you don't get thrown off track with, you know, minutiae and distractions and mistakes. But if you keep your eye on the ball, you'll get there. You know, suddenly it'll happen. It might seem like you're not making any progress, but all of a sudden, boom, something will spring into place. Yeah.
What's been the most challenging? What's the most challenging about running Maximum Life?
Probably not having the facilities, because I made some big mistakes with money and poured a bunch of millions actually over time into different things. I prematurely into the wrong things, betting on the wrong people, and I actually learned a lesson after picking two wrong partners. I didn't learn that the first one was the wrong one, you know, how bad the wrong first one was until after I'd already gotten the second one. But the biggest challenge was you know, recouping from that. And then the biggest challenge I'm facing now, because I don't have the resources I had at one time, is to do a lot of things for myself that I really don't want to do. So it's outsourcing. I'm not a good outsourcer. I'm one of these guys that knows that I hate doing this and hate doing that. But what I would almost hate doing more is bringing somebody in, recruiting them,
training them,
finding out there if I made a mishire, which I've done. I hope I learned how to hire better. Then you have to start the whole process over. And meanwhile, the day-to-day operations suffer.
Right.
But I know that's a cop-out. That's what I should do. And
right. The same reason you need to do it is why you don't want to do it. Yeah.
Yeah. No, you don't, but time. I'm actually in the process of doing something like that. But the hardest part about it is the minutia and the operational stuff. I'm not an operations guy. I'm more of an idea, you know, kind of creative.
Imagination,
guy.
Yeah, idea.
Yeah, yeah.
What other mentors are important to mention? I know we mentioned Dr. Glombos.
Dr. Ward. Dr. Ward was a chemist. Unfortunately, he was not with us anymore. He was very much into life extension philosophy. He was an idea man, author, amazing author, and publisher. And gosh, he. Oh, I'm running out. I'm running out of battery. I think you're going to lose me here in a minute. Jeremy, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. I'm here.
Okay. You're going to lose me. My battery's running out. I just got the warning. But he was a major mentor. I've had probably 100 of them. And the reason I say that is virtually every good book that I ever read that has anything to do with attitude, with personal development, with business, I try to read the best ones. And when I do find a really good one, that person, the author, becomes a mentor.
Yeah.
So I credit a lot of people with contributing to my credo, for example. Yeah.
Dave, this has been fantastic. I really greatly appreciate your time and knowledge and everything you're doing. Where should we send people? Where should they check out?
Well, you know, maxlife.org, mm-hmm. maxlife.org, mm-hmm. Is my main page. From there, you'll find a link on the upper left corner of the home page. You'll find a link to PsyCog Systems, and also to BioViva.
Yeah.
Those, if you're interested in what's going to make all this happen, the technologies, those are two of the key technologies.
Yeah.
And so it'll take you to those sites. If you want to find the Manhattan Beach Project, that's manhattanbeachproject.com.
Yeah.
And those are pretty much it.
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of information on there.
Thank you.
You read all this stuff.
Exactly. It's worth it. It's worthwhile.
Maybe you did. I don't know if you saw PsyCog or Bio.
I saw Age Reversal. I didn't see PsyCog, actually.
Yeah, they're now. They haven't been up too long. Yeah.
I'll have to check it out.
Okay.
But thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Jeremy. Really wonderful finally meeting you and talking with you. I heard about you and good things, all good things.
Thank you.
And maybe we can, where are you located?
I'm in Chicago, actually. I was reading that your mom's originally from Chicago?
Who, Joe?
Your mom is originally from Chicago.
Yeah, my mom, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
My mom was born in Chicago, and ended up her you know, my grandfather moved to Johnstown, Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
And worked in that railroad, and that's where she met my dad. She met him at a wedding.
Yeah.
And I held a family reunion for their 50th anniversary, and
that's amazing.
Another one for their 60th. So that was a lot of fun.
Yeah. I was going to ask about that on your list of special gratitude too, because obviously I read the whole credo. You have this list of scientists, and then in the middle you have Gary C. Halbert, which is, I'm like, okay, you have all these people, then you have one of the best direct response marketers, copywriters.
Oh my God. And a character. What a character. He and I were really good friends. In fact, that's how I met Joe Polish. I met Joe through Gary. Yeah.
That's amazing. So,
but yeah, it's, I'm sorry, I got off the track, but what was that?
No, you were just saying Gary Halbert. So did he, is that how, where you got the idea to put the two ads in there?
Yeah, actually, no. I mean, the idea was mine, the two ads, but just the idea of, you know, how to write copy. And I'm not a good copywriter, but I, you know, for little classifieds, I get by. And I just came up with that idea. And then one other idea I came up with was I didn't know I was violating SEC rules. I wasn't in all the ads, but there was one thing that the SEC slapped my hands because I was actually selling a security. I had no idea what was going on. In fact, I invested in the company myself, was trying to find other investors, and somebody from Kansas complained about it, and they came up with somebody, they called me, one of the securities people, they called the securities guys in Pennsylvania, and I ended up having to pay like $500, you know, to cover their cost of investigating me, but and not run that ad again. But I ended up getting around that by thinking of, and Gary loved this, by the way, thinking about, well, we can't advertise for investors, so I started advertising for partners, you know, partner wanted. Mm-hmm. And then in the body, I say financial partner with expertise in this, 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 and that we want to partner for that. So it accomplished the same thing. Actually got a better response.
Nice.
Yeah, so Gary did like that a lot. Yeah.
Should I cut that out, or are you allowed to say that?
No. That's a matter of record. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's the, I didn't know. You know, made a mistake.
And, it's.
I mean, it was.
You have such great stories. This could go for. You know, the next week we could, like, the sun could be coming up. Like, we should do Dr. Columbo style.
Well, do you ever come to California?
Of course, yeah.
Like, look me up when you come out here. I'm in Newport Beach.
Okay, I will definitely do that.
My number and everything. What I got, you can't buy. It resides between my eyes. Walked through the fire, came out better on the other side. See, life's like a beach if you find the sand. And right now, I'm feeling like 100 grand.